Hello and welcome to the OPIP podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we will talk about the role of the blockchain in central banks' digital currencies, known as CBDC. I'm Chris Ostrowski, the Commercial Director at OPIP from London, and today we have Vijak Sethupat from the Bank of Thailand in Bangkok and Sky Gao from Cypherium in New York. Welcome. If I may, I'd like to start by asking you both a question about your sort of personal work in this area. I'd like to know when you both came to realize that CBDCs were something that were more than just a technological experiment and something that could be quite a new phenomenon and quite a watermark in the history of finance and money, particularly in the role of how central banks issue and deal with money. Starting with you, Sky, you've worked in this area for a while. When did you realize the potential of CBDCs?
So I actually, back in 2017, wrote an article about CBDC and how blockchain could help implement. The Bitcoin was quite a buzzword back then because it first passed the $10,000 mark and rallying approaching to $20,000. So no financial institution and the government could continue to ignore the presence of Bitcoin. But after reaching the all-time high price, Bitcoin suddenly crashed to like $3,000 level. And that dramatic volatility fluctuation in price could not make Bitcoin an ideal currency. So that's why people started thinking about digital currency issued by central banks, because first, the central bank digital currency has stable value, and also because it's centralized, it's unlike Bitcoin, so that it can be much faster than Bitcoin. For example, like Alipay could process 100,000 transactions per second, but Bitcoin could do only 12. That's why CBDC started getting interesting around that time.
Thank you, Sky. Now, that really is fascinating. I mean, people come from all sorts of different backgrounds. And for you, it was the crash in Bitcoin and the realization that Bitcoin would perhaps have more limits than might have been realized that brought you into this world of the development of central bank digital currencies. Vijak, what about you as a central banker? When was the moment that you saw the potential of CBDC as a new phenomenon?
So for us, it's about 2017 that we kind of see the sort of the wider adoption of a cryptocurrency and some of the blockchain application. So our governor would have a vision of this technology that would be very useful for improving financial infrastructure in Thailand. So he initiated our project, which is called Internon, at that time. And we start in 2018 for our first phase, and fascinating since then. But we start on what we call the wholesale CBDC. So it's a central bank and the banks pretty much. So we start with the real-time gross settlement system, and we work all the way forward.
It's fascinating here. I mean, the trigger for this is the governor wanting to improve the processes, wanting it to be better for the Thai people so that they can use the baht. It's often one of the motivations that we hear from central banks, that they want it to be better than what it is. If I'm being honest, and not all central banks will say this, but some of them were actually a little bit scared by big tech companies. Some of them were scared by Libra. Some of them were scared by what Facebook were doing or by other institutions and worried about their power diminishing. But I think that the process argument is one that we often hear from official sectors, to make it better than it was so that it can work better for the people, work better for the economy. Talk to us a bit more, Vijak, about the policy priorities in Project Internon. I mean, why did you do it? What did you want to achieve from the RTGS, real-time growth settlement experiment, and how did it go?
We saw the potential of this technology to really help the financial infrastructure in our country, and that's why we kind of initiated the project. And another one that we kind of do in this project internal is we involve the industry. So we invite 8 commercial banks in Thailand to sort of help us study this new technology together. Because we think that as a community, we could learn and we could experience this new technology together. So we know this enough to be able to like do it for production. That's why we invite all the banks with us also. And the first project that we try to do is we try to mimic the real-time cross settlement system that is very efficient already in Thailand. But the argument or the thing that the distributed ledger technology could tell us is maybe 3 things. The first one is because our existing system is centralized, so that means it's a single point of failure. So if anything happened to that system, country will be paralyzed. So with the distributed nature of this technology, we want to understand better how they can help us with this sort of the single point of failure with the distributed technology could help us. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. The second thing is of the efficiency that the system can accurately provide. Because there are a lot of process improvement that could be done digitally. So by sort of study this, we hope that digitization could help with the process efficiency. And the third one is extra kind of functionality that the system can provide. The one that we study in the first phase of Internode is what we call the gridlock mechanism that can it can provide the what we call the liquidity saving mechanism for the bank to lower the cash that they have to put into the cross settlement system to be able to do the settlement. We implement the mechanism for them to be able to save this liquidity.
And you can see how that will improve the process and achieve one of your governor's aspirations in doing that. So you've got 3 outcomes there, you know, overcoming or removing the single point of failure issue, increasing efficiency and allowing better functionality and better ease of use on the liquidity side. For all those objectives, would you say that the blockchain was the essential component that allowed you to do that, or could you have achieved those objectives on the RTGS without the blockchain?
I would say so.
You would say it was essential. Exactly. Yeah. Well, this is what is probably the crux of the argument here. The idea of the distributed ledger technology, particularly with that central point of failure, is absolutely one of the things that makes this so interesting. In terms of how central banks make their design choices when doing this, this is a question for you, Sky, really. Is the blockchain a piece of technology and a new innovation that can help them with their policy outcomes? Is it clear enough that this is the policy, that the policy outcomes can be met with the application of the blockchain in the way that Vijay just described?
I believe it is. The CBDC design focuses on availability, accuracy, functionality, transaction speed, and privacy protection. A blockchain can satisfy all of these requirements. It's a distributed ledger system and is resilient to a wider variety of attacks. Blockchain tech can send digital currency anywhere in the world in a matter of minutes or even seconds. Blockchain can establish centralized identity and prevent massive data breaches. Also, smart contracts can automatically and precisely complete payments instructed by computer codes.
Exactly. So the use of the blockchain there is one of the things that can overcome some of the issues that we can see CBDCs trying to solve. Obviously, smart contracts are connected to that. Staying with you, Sky, I mean, where would a smart contract most help a central bank? What are the areas which the application of a smart contract in a CBDC could be most useful?
A smart contract can do a lot of things. So first, central banks can build digital exchanges with smart contracts, enable delivery versus payment for financial instruments and assets, allowing instant interbank settlement. Smart contract can also prevent financial crime, such as money laundering and embezzlement, For example, a Florida man recently bought a Lamborghini using the government bailout funds that was supposed to pay employee salaries for those who lost their payment during the COVID-19. With the smart contracts, the government funds can be limited to designated uses only. And also, what's interesting is that there's a new business model in cryptocurrency space called DeFi, which stands for Decentralized Finance. Borrowing and the lending are done via smart contracts and the interest automatically paid. The problem with DeFi is that first, the value of the cryptocurrencies are highly unstable, and second, they are unregulated. However, governments can borrow from this model, allowing qualified parties to issue digital assets backed by real-world assets, such as real estate or stocks, and use them as collaterals and get loans in CBDCs. This could bring huge liquidity into the economy.
Thank you, Sky. I mean, it's fascinating to hear about decentralized finance and the way that you talk about within cryptocurrencies. I mean, from a central bank's point of view, Vijay, I mean, decentralized financing does involve other parties issuing and holding digital assets. Is this something that a well-designed smart contract can cope with in a CBDC? Is it something that a central bank would be happy to program into a smart contract for that to happen?
Smart contract is our objective for the phase two of the project Internode. We explore the functionality of the smart contract like the Skype have described. So we mimic the bond life cycle. So the bond itself can pay coupons and they can exchange between the parties. We have something called repurchase. So you can sell it and then you can get it back in another time. So that's a repo. And also the trading. So mimic our bond life cycle using the smart contract. And we also using the smart contract tools kind of verify the transfer between banks, between the customer with two banks. So they can verify the beneficiary status and we can program it to pay or not to pay if it doesn't reach the criteria. And we also implement it in terms of the regulatory in Thailand, we have a capital control, so they have some rules for the capital control. So we implement the smart contract to do that also. So back to your question about the DeFi and ability to have other people kind of holding this digital asset. One thing that we kind of concerned with that is how can we identify the person? So like KYC kind of things is very important to us. So that kind of the one we did with the smart contract.
And Sky, that KYC element to it, every central bank is going to say this. They're going to talk about knowing who the person is. What's the solution for this as we try and roll out smart contracts into the CBDC space?
We could embed a digital identity into each transaction, like the accounts or the recipients. And because there's a data privacy issue, so we could leverage blockchain's decentralized identity. We can just embed like a digital fingerprint on the transaction to prove that the transaction is sent from a person. And also the government should retain the KYC information regarding that person and does not store the personal data on the blockchain itself, but separately. While looking at the transaction, that digital fingerprint will match the personal sensitive data of that person so that the KYC process could be done. And we actually developed a digital identity solution with Randstad and Google Cloud. And in that use case, we use smart contract to automatically verify the digital signature against the data of a person. And the storage is decentralized so that there is like a little chance for data breach.
Vijay, listening to that type of explanation on how this can exist, what would you see would be the biggest sort of challenges here? the anonymity, the privacy, the KYC, all of these things kind of combine into a, there's a bit of tension around this. But it does sound like there's a clear path with the technology. So making sure that the KYC demands are satisfied and the anonymity is satisfied in the distributed way described. As you go on to do more of this, I mean, this whether we call it decentralized finance or the distribution of issuance of digital assets, is this something that you think is going to be and will be part of the CBDC space that the Bank of Thailand are working in?
I think one of the thing that's kind of important for in the financial transaction is the privacy issues. Because we found that in our work a lot. So first, okay, we have to know what the customer is, right? And when they do transact, they don't want other not involved party to know about it. So that's a part of the sort of privacy issue. So I think this tool is kind of the sort of main requirement to be able to kind of develop this the sort of DeFi for the future. We kind of keep track of the latest development in the DeFi space, and we kind of study it closely. But I think they have to answer these two big questions of sort of KYC and privacy.
And Sky, tell us a bit more about this. So you've got this decentralized ID system. So this is something which is, I suppose, different. I mean, does that really serve this requirement that in our own OMFIF surveys we know is important, that Vizhak knows is important, of the people involved in the transaction being the only ones involved in the transaction, and that's it. We know no third party unconnected to the transaction listening in or looking in. Does what you have developed meet that requirement? Because this is what a lot of people do talk about in terms of its importance.
There will be different layers that handling the identity and the transaction information. So first is the blockchain layer, a blockchain layer that stores the transaction details. And as you know, for Bitcoin, it's anonymous. So in the Bitcoin blockchain, there are only strings of addresses, and these addresses have no actual meaning. They are just generated by algorithms. And you cannot just link one's identity with the addresses so that the blockchain itself is anonymous. And also, we have a special field called identity indicator. So, or you can call it identifier. So for that, it's actually a hash of a personal identity. So the personal identity could include such as an ID number and its full name, address, and age, those information. And that's unique to every user of the blockchain or the digital currency. And that information will be held on a separate data center rather than the blockchain data itself. So if you want like full privacy, you could also make the blockchain private that only, like say, the central bank official have access to it, no one else. But like to make it more secure, adding an extra layer of protection. In our solution, we do not store the personal data directly on a blockchain. So we just store an identifier that can be linked to the personal identity that's stored elsewhere.
That sounds like a complex but workable solution, but one that probably does require the type of experimentation that Project Infinon and others have been undertaking. One of the things that obviously is essential for us to even bother doing this is the interoperability between different CBDCs. Because to be honest, if you were to just do one on its own in a small island economy, you could probably do it, perhaps wouldn't even need blockchain. But what we're really talking about here, and this is where I think a lot of people do get quite excited about this topic, is this idea that you can transfer money as if it were cash virtually between two people in different countries and in different jurisdictions. Obviously, speed is important. You know, immediate final settlement is something which is very has not been really possible to achieve to date in kind of history of money. And as we look at the reasons for this, and we look at how closely countries psychologically feel ownership of their currency and their sovereignty, and the reason why it's difficult to transfer money from one place to another, between one person and another, is often linked to policy decisions to do with capital controls and the fear of money leaving the country. I'd like, I suppose, Vijay, for you first, just to talk a little bit about the experiment that you did with HKMA and why you chose that particular jurisdiction and what it was, and whether you think this is the first step towards wider CBDC usage or a model which could be replicated.
Yes, thank you. Our project with the HKMA is what we call kind of a phase three. But we actually name it Lion Rock Internon project because HKMA have a Lion Rock project, which is a similar project, but it's inside the country. And why HKMA? At this point, at the same time kind of thing, we want to be able to transfer between countries. And there are some other projects that have already passed this phase. They have their path. So we found that HKMA is having the kind of the same objective with us. So we paired together to create this internal Lion Rock project. And what we try to achieve is we want to study this interoperability between two RTGS from different countries. How can we sort of transfer the money from one place to the other place using this new technology and with our what we call the corresponding banks model, that typical model that people use during this time. So we kind of come up with a new model that we call the corridor network that sort of connect the Thai blockchain to the Hong Kong blockchain, RTGS. And we can transfer the money across border. So that's kind of our objective, to be able to study how this interoperability between blockchain or DLT system interact, and what kind of question or what kind of problems or issues that we have to face in this kind of experiment. So I think the experiment went well. We can do this transfer between countries. But one of the main issues that we found is this is have nothing to do with the technology, but it's the problem, how can we find the liquidity to kind of match? Because the transfer between Thailand and Hong Kong is not equal. So when we do this transfer in the corridor network, we have to have what we call the settlement bank to kind of help with the liquidity shortage of one side to kind of balance it out so we can do this transfer successfully. So it's become kind of the kind of economics or finance kind of a problem that we kind of found along the way. The technology itself is doable, but this is more complicated stuff.
Yes, and it's not really a surprise that even during the experimentation, the liquidity issue and the kind of imbalance of transfers in each direction are the thing that causes the problem. And if you look at the heritage of that, that makes sense as to why it is difficult in the first place and why borders exist. I mean, Sky, look, what is the vision here? I mean, instant transaction finality. Tell us how this works. What does the customer have in their hand? Mr. Wong, who lives in Hong Kong, what does he have in his hand, you know, to make this the reality?
Instant transaction settlement means that the transaction, once they are sent, it settles. So through the blockchain technology, because the newest technology of blockchain supports transaction finality. So that means when you like send it from your device and the recipient can just receive the your payment and start using it, there's like no intermediary, no settlement banks. It all happens automatically on the blockchain.
And what does the customer need? I mean, do they need a working phone? How do you see this in the day-to-day life of someone?
From the customer's end, they only need any device that can access the blockchain. That could be a phone or a computer or tablet, as long as they could download a software that can connect to the blockchain, they are able to receive payments.
Okay, so the accessibility is there. I mean, this does open up other questions that we're not going to go into today about the kind of geospatial reality of cash compared to other things. But I think even with that degree of accessibility that you've got the kind of vision to get there. At the moment, putting aside the Lion Rock Enthanon experiment, the SWIFT method of having a BAX code, having a SWIFT code that we're all used to of how you transfer money abroad, still is the way that most of these individual types of transfers or corporate transfers are made. What do we think is it going to take to kind of remove this quite established system? I mean, SWIFT is a company that run this, but there are other parts to this infrastructure as well, which are deeply embedded that have existed for a long time. In terms of how that changes, you're looking at it from a psychological point of view, Vijay, what is the thing that's going to change how it works? Is it the innovation in that system itself, or is it a transfer to a new system, the like of which you've been experimenting with and the like of which Cypherium has been developing? What route do you see it going? Innovation, improvement, using the system people know well, or a switch?
I would think that it's maybe improvement. Just one little note for the internal Lion Rock, because it's a wholesale CBDC. So we just working just only at the central bank and the bank level. We haven't gone down to the sort of customer level. So the transfer from a bank in Thailand to the bank in Hong Kong, in our experiment. But going back to your question, I think it's probably the existing system may have to kind of improve because switching to a new, and we got this a lot also in our experiment, saying that distributed ledger technology or blockchain is a kind of emerging technology. They haven't have really like set a standard of who's going to be the winner in terms of the blockchain yet. So a lot of people still have a doubt that this technology is still young and still developing, and we haven't really see who's going to be like de facto standard yet. So I think the way the existing player, they need to kind of improve the system and try to sort of provide this kind of functionality that blockchain is providing.
And Sky, from your point of view, in terms of the existing systems that are there at the moment, what is the key benefit in terms of the changes that will be experienced by the participants in this community that only blockchain can do? What's the secret sauce that only blockchain can do?
I believe that the secret sauce is interoperability that blockchain can enable. Interoperability is challenging because most CBDCs are designed with centralized or semi-centralized architecture. They cannot access each other without intermediaries. A public blockchain like Cypherium enables two types of scenarios. First is payment to a recipient who doesn't have an account of a specific CBDC. And the second is payment to a recipient who accepts another CBDC or conventional currency. Cash does not have this issue because a physical transfer can be done without the presence of an account, but this is not easy for CBDCs. With Cypherium, the sender can send the payment coins to a connector, usually a bank, and the connector will create a mirror payment on Cypherium and transfer it to the recipient's address or account. Because Cypherium ledger is publicly visible, the connector cannot create coins out of thin air. The connector can control the KYC and AML process with smart contracts. And also, the timeline of CBDC adoption varies from country to country, and CBDCs must coexist with legacy payment system for a long time, and they need to be interoperable with them. Cypherium, moreover, features an instant transaction finality. It uses the fastest Byzantine fault tolerance consensus algorithm capable of processing thousands of transactions per second. Early this year, I just mentioned that we implemented the decentralized ID system with Randstad and Google Cloud. Central banks can program business logics using our Java smart contract. And as Jack just mentioned, there is no de facto standard exist yet, but for banks, there is a standard called ISO 222, which serves as a standard interbank communication protocol. And we chose Java rather than Ethereum Solidity because Java supports data objects like XML, which is the ISO 222 standard messaging schema. And we are happy to assist Bank of Thailand integrate our technology in the next steps.
Thank you, Sky. Well, that's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, there's so much still to be experimented and developed here. Vijay, from your point of view, you've done this quite far-reaching experiment. It's quite impressive with the HKMA and the project you did with the Bank of Thailand in Project Infinon itself. If you look at the different parts of the work that you've done, what's been the most surprising thing so far? And what is it that is stopping this being something which people are queuing around the block to do? Why aren't Thai corporates and Thai commercial banks saying, we want more of this, roll out CBDCs, roll out the digital smart contract bond? Talk to us about the best thing and talk to us about the challenges and barriers to adoption as we come to an end. And I'll ask Guy to finish.
My background is in kind of technical. I studied computer science in college. And so the surprise that I have is I think this is not just the technology. When we implement this, we saw that it's the interconnect with others field. And for me, I kind of like new to those kind of field. So for example, the like foreign exchange market or some of these financial instrument that kind of have things of their own. And also when we talk about the CBDC, I think the legal and the macroeconomics is coming to play. So this is the a lot more than that I know. So I think this is my surprise on this kind of project because I thought I can code. I don't understand DLT. Mm-hmm. I don't understand blockchain. I can do this. Yeah. But to do it successfully, then you need to bring people that have expertise on those kind of area to help you because I used to say that technology can do everything. Like we can do program, we can do everything, but how to do it and kind of conform or doesn't have a consequence in other field, for example, the law, the macroeconomics effect, things like that. I think that's the thing that most sort of surprised me because I think, it's just the technology could do this coding.
So yes, the world of central banking have these other realities outside of technology. And talk to us about the barriers to adoption, the kind of challenges that you would like to overcome to make the CBDC rollout a reality.
I think one of the biggest problem is the one I just told in the previous question, because this kind of technology is kind of new and it's kind of emerging. And there are many ways people kind of solve some of this problem. For example, the scalability, interoperability, privacy. So it's kind of new. And many people do not believe in this kind of like this new technology, so still have doubt. So I think that's the biggest hurdle that we have to try to like sort of convince them to see the benefit of this technology, and with the risk or something that they can bring with it, so they can understand this better and kind of believe in this potential of this kind of technology. I think that's the biggest hurdle for me.
Thank you, Vijay. That's very interesting. And Sky, what about you? So since you're obviously from the crypto asset space and you've come into the more of this more institutionalized public official space as you've tried to do more research and more work here, what's been the biggest surprise to you and what are the biggest barriers to the blockchain and the CBDC with the DLT being more widely pushed out more quickly?
That DLT and the CBDC development happens faster than we expect. Like Libra, there was like a rumor that Mark Zuckerberg is going to launch this in 2018, and they confirmed just in the next year. And it also accelerated other CBDC developments, including the ECEP by People's Bank of China and the Bank of France experiment. So that, as you can see now, many central banks are rolling out their own blockchain solution or experiment. But as Vijay mentioned, there is no standard yet, and they have different goals. So for example, the China's DCEP is a retail CBDC, while the Bank of France and Bank of Thailand CBDC are focusing on the wholesale side. So that means like when they finally go live, going to the actual use, there will be a new infrastructure that's needed to connect all the CBDCs because they are built with different technology. And I believe that the CBDC needs a new infrastructure rather than like SWIFT. The reason is that SWIFT requires like a manual entry of recipients' information. It involves multiple intermediaries, takes several days and costs $100 to send a message. And it builds expensive membership fees and installation fees. If CBDC still use legacy systems for cross-border transactions, their performances will be bound by the lower limit of that legacy system. And adopting a new infrastructure can unlock all the benefits of CBDCs. Blockchain can match the speed of the CBDCs, and it's also much cheaper. A transaction can be executed simply by scanning a QR code and settling in a few seconds. And there are also technologies that can connect conventional payment system to blockchains, streamlining the upgrade process. So blockchain is ready to solve these challenges.
Thank you, Sky. Fascinating insight into the role that blockchain can play as CBDC becomes developed. Certainly OMFIF's role and the reason why we launched the Digital Monetary Institute was to overcome some of those issues that you're talking about. If you look at the countries that are doing the wholesale experiments, of Swiss National Bank, the Bank of France, the Bank of Thailand, we don't want a situation where the blockchain technologies are unable to talk to each other. So the more of these central banks that work together with OMFIF and the Digital Monetary Institute, the more we can overcome some of those barriers. And also those psychological and really quite historic barriers, not more challenges perhaps than barriers, as to the reason why things are as they are, is not something which is easy to overcome. And on the Official Monetary and Financial Institutions Forum, which have been working with central banks for a long time, is quite well situated to talking about this, because you do have two different worlds sometimes colliding here. But this discussion has been absolutely fascinating to see what the potential is. And I think, Sky, you were very convincing there in showing why blockchain really is the thing that makes it different enough to make it worth it, which is really what a lot of these discussions are about. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we certainly have a public panel, which might have already happened by the time we release this podcast. But if it hasn't, it's on the 19th of August this year. And that too will cover the role of technology and blockchain in CBDCs. And we would love to hear you if you have a question on that panel. If you've got any questions from based on what you heard today, please feel free to email me on chris.ostrowski@omfif.org. And to find out more information, go to www.omfif/DMI. Thank you for joining us. It's been great to speak to you all. If you've enjoyed the podcast, then you can also subscribe to this on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you very much.